The Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Oh dear, I brought the wrong book.
Wing it.
Okay. This is on...
That's a good one.
You think this is a good one?
Do it.
You see bipartisanship over on the left side of our committee.
All right, well, let's do this. This saying comes from Exit Wounds by Derek McGinnis, who's an Iraq war veteran. And it's under coming home in pain, because we know we're addressing a lot of our veterans who are in pain. And this is by David McGinnis. He said, "We were fortunate that we could take the time off to fly to the East Coast to be there with Derek when he came back. I think it was incredibly important that we were there, because even though most of the nurses and medical staff were terrific, they couldn't do everything. We were able to pick up some slack there. And of course, we were family, which is probably the most important support network any wounded veteran can have. So that's the first thing. If you can go and be with your loved one, go." Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues, if you look at the schedule today, we have three public hearings, which we're going to do last, and then we have three work sessions, and you'll see that there's four bills down there in your list. So we're actually going to be doing a work session on SB 85, which we'll come back to, and then SCR 8, we need to move another committee. And then only for the purposes today of getting additional testimony, we're going to open a temporary work session on 432 and 434, get some info from there, and then bring these back again at a later point, probably next week. So with that, to get the business that has to be done today, I'm going to open a work session on SB 85. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 85 was previously heard on March 3rd. This is the measure that the City of Portland and Representative Boone testified to that permits local governments to provide financial assistance to qualifying real property owners for seismic preparedness improvements. It describes the type of assistance and the parameters of the financial arrangements. Conditions the financial agreements on written notice and consent of any affected mortgagees as specified in the bill, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There's no amendment and there's no subsequent referral, no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Until all the paperwork's ready.
That's correct.
Madam Vice Chair?
Right here. Okay, Senator Boquist, I move Senate Bill 85 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Honorable Vice Chair Amanis Anderson moves SB 85 to the floor with a due pass recognition. Is there discussion? Is there any discussion on SB 244? Since there's no discussion.
No, but you know, I do want to make a comment that I have another bill that's going to be coming to this committee, or maybe it's already in this committee, regarding seismic. What local governments should maybe do for getting prepared for a seismic mishap in our areas. But we'll address housing, but also medical, a lot of different things. So this is something that we really need to do. I feel it's very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on SB 85. Is there any opposition to SB 85? Then we'll move it to the floor. And since you are the expert on Madam Vice Chair.
I should have kept my mouth shut.
You should have. Would you be delighted enough to carry this bill?
I would love to carry it.
With that, we're going to close the work session SB 85, open a work session on SCR 8. And why are we doing this again, Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 8 is for strictly for a re-referral to rules at the president's discretion.
Madam Vice Chair.
Okay, Senator or Chair Boquist, I move SCR 8 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves SCR 8 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? If there's none, motion passes. SCR 8 goes back to the President's office for action. And with that, we'll close the work session SCR 8. And for the purposes of taking any additional public testimony, we're going to open a work session both on SB 432 and SB 434. And I know Mr. Rocco is here to provide a few comments at the request of one of the members. And is there anybody else there that wants to provide public testimony on 432 or 434? Please come up and join Mr. Rocco. And there is some information that it has been distributed to members, and I believe is on OLIS. Mr. Rocco. I know Senator Devlin threw you under the bus. Thumpity thump. We hear that. He was detained elsewhere.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, Ken Rocco with the Legislative Fiscal Office. I was asked to come and make a few comments for Senator Devlin and others on Senate Bill 432. I just wanted to point out I've worked for the legislature for a couple months short of 25 years. And during that time, there's been a couple of consistent themes that the Legislative Fiscal Office has provided in its nonpartisan role. The first is basically don't willingly give up your legislative authority to the executive branch, the judicial branch, or to anyone else through passing bills with certain language in it. And the second is maintain as much flexibility as you can when it comes to the state's revenues and resources. For this second point, I think it's important that you try not to dedicate funds to a specific purpose. You try not to tie your fiscal hands so that you are less left with less flexibility, and that you try to keep in mind that conditions change, priorities change, and so you need to look at the current conditions when you're making decisions. Ways and Means is charged with a very difficult task, which is producing a balanced budget every 2 years. This is more difficult in certain times under certain conditions, and given what the current situation is, one of the things that Ways and Means tries to do is we call it the reappropriation of other fund account balances. The building calls it fund sweeps. That's a more common term. Ways and Means doesn't do this lightly. It's usually after serious consideration about the balances in the accounts and whether there's a significant need to redirect those account balances to another purpose. Or if there's a specific reason, for example, like the program no longer exists, but there's money left in the account, kind of a thing like that. So we really do this on the basis of two principles. The first is that the legislature created this other funds account originally, and it set up the program to use the funds that are in the account. So therefore, the legislature can either temporarily or permanently change the nature of that account or change the nature of the fund and redirect the use of it. The second principle is that priorities do change, and one legislature cannot bind a future legislature. So if conditions have changed, statutory language can be changed to repurpose those funds for a different use. In Senate Bill 432 is related to the 911 accounts. The last time funds from these accounts were transferred to the general fund for general government purposes was in the 09 session. And that was done not prospectively to fix the 09-11 budget, but because forecasts had changed and we were in a hole for the 07-09 budget period. It was one of about 40 accounts at that time that were looked at, and monies were reappropriated from those accounts to the general fund to cover the hole that the budget was in. And at that time, the total that was moved from the enhanced 911 subaccount was $3.1 million. That left a balance of $3.9 million in the account. So Ways and Means did not take the full amount. And then there was another $500,000 from the Enhanced 911 Equipment Replacement Subaccount at the same time. And that was done because there had been no anticipated uses for that money in the current biennium. And the next time a distribution was made, the money, the $500,000, would have been put back into that account. So it's not something that's done on a frequent basis. So that's...
So I'm looking for your professional advice here, which is why you're here. In a case like 911 is the example that we have here, but in a situation in which we've been trying to, since 2005, Senator Verger and I co-chaired a committee, the Emergency Preparedness Committee, and you probably recall this, and what we've been trying to work towards is, and I know a lot of people don't like to hear it, is the consolidation of 911 centers. And we've actually... ironically been somewhat successful in getting it down from the 48 to somewhere in the neighborhood of 43 right now. And of course our carrot and stick to make it more efficient so that we don't have to raise fees and we don't have to make your guys' job miserable is going to 21st century. So the unfortunate problem we have is you have to kind of build up some of these reserves in a 911 account as an example, and then take those reserves and buy that 21st century technology and convince two or three more of these people to merge together, because it just is not efficient having so many of these centers. In that sort of scenario, what is the best mechanism you see? You've been here 20-some years, for a policy committee to be reminding and telling, you know, the Ways and Means Committee, well, the reason we're doing this is to be able to move into the 21st century, make it more efficient, so you guys don't have to come up with more money someplace else to backfill this. What, you got any suggestions on how we tell our colleagues in Ways and Means to...
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that Senate Bill 432 is clearly a statement of the importance that your committee has placed on the maintenance of that account and only be used for emergency communications. And I think in many cases, when an account is set up, the intent is that it is there for a reason and that reason should stand unless something of a bigger priority comes to bear. And I think the problem is at some point in time, based on the overall general revenue situation of the state, the Ways and Means Committee may feel that a balance in an account that's sitting there in preparation for some use but not actually being used may be better served to be used for education purposes, for state police purposes, for other needs that will not be fulfilled if the budget goes as predicted because of revenue situations.
Right. Or the next stock market crash.
Right, that's correct. Yes.
I said on revenue, that's what I'm worried about.
Yes.
Are there, we asked him to come to enlighten us. Any questions?
Yeah, I have some. And I can appreciate the fact, I've got the numbers here of what was swept. And I can appreciate the fact, too, that, you know, we like to separate the two legislative branches, the governor and us. I put the clause in there, the emergency clause, to have the governor stand up and say, we have an emergency. I'm going to allow the legislature to go sweep this money. Sometimes the legislature sweeps when the governor might not think it's an emergency, but the legislator does because we don't have enough money to put into this. The point I want to make, you mentioned that sometimes it's better to put it into education. Well, this technology that we try to purchase is expensive. We can't just write a check for it and then get it and put it in and have it used. We have to build up a savings account so we can pay for it. Now, perhaps I should change this bill to say that when we need this technology, the 911 folks can come to us and say, we need it, and we pay for it. And then we use these taxes to pay it off, because you said when it's sitting there not being used. So maybe perhaps we buy the stuff and then use this money to pay it off. That way this money is always being used. The problem is that as we take it, we get behind in our technology. And this committee right here has put forth a valiant effort on emergency readiness. 911 communications is just that readiness we need to have updated. We need to have the top quality communications that we can ever have, and we can't do it when we take these funds. So the importance is when we look at the fact that, yeah, we swept $15 million, what would $15 million buy in today's new technology? a lot. And the good chair has talked about the fact that some of our 911, our PSAP groups are consolidating. They're getting together because it's getting too expensive to buy this technology, and we don't have the money to buy it. So maybe I had to just change this bill and say, we're going to go buy it. We're going to have the legislator have Ways and Means come up with a way for us to buy this, and then we'll put the money in and we'll pay it back as we go. Would that be a better way to work?
But let me rephrase the question. Is there a legal, because I don't understand the bonding authorities. I know there's a GF, H, Y, Z, X, Y, Zulu, the rest of these.
All these
is
bonds.
There a mechanism out there in which, you know, if we identified, you know, a plan forward over about more than a biennium, that you can bond or do something to get this type of equipment center set up?
Z bonds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney is fond of Z-bonds, which currently don't exist, but we're working on that. I think I would just like to reiterate that right now, and since 2009, the Ways and Means Committee has expressed no interest in taking these account balances for any purpose, because we've had sufficient revenues and the state hasn't been in a fiscal emergency situation. And again, we do not look around for other account balances unless there is a true crisis in the state of Oregon. So I see no need to do anything more with this bill to try to protect those funds, because if the time came where the Ways and Means Committee would be looking at this, I think it would be a much larger discussion than just the Ways and Means Committee. It would be all members of the legislature saying that we're in a fiscal crisis and we may need to look at other resources because we don't have enough revenue to provide basic services to the state.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, quick follow-up.
Remember,
he's just the messenger. Okay?
I know that. The problem is that when we get $1 or $2 million in there, that's not enough to do anything with. And when we get $5 or $10 million, everybody's eyes gets real big and says, "Oh, there's a pot of money, and it's not doing anything. So let's take it." And therein lies the problem, because we need to get those larger amounts so we can buy this technology that we have to have. I mean, we're talking resilience. We're talking the big subduction fault. We're talking the big earthquake, the big tsunami. And what are we going to say as a legislative body when we go, 911, where are they? Where are they? Because they don't have the technology to get through. What do we say?
I think that's more of a statement, right?
That's a statement.
Okay. You have a question, Senator Courtney?
Thank you. Chair Voquist, Strzok, I'm well aware of how I feel about you professionally and personally. I have immense respect and admiration and fondness for you, even though we fight a lot. I have to ask you a question. By what path are you here? Why are you here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I was asked to be here to talk about the need for maintaining flexibility of resources.
Who asked you?
We did. Yeah, Senator Courtney, if you remember, I didn't want to move this bill because I revere the Ways and Means.
Okay.
And then it was said maybe we should have the Ways and Means chair come
right
to tell us
correct
the importance of not
right
throwing away any.
Right. I didn't.
Okay.
And where was the co-chair of Ways and Means?
He was unavailable. Isn't he?
Well, you tell Richard I'm looking for him. But I'll be frank with you why. He is staff. I mean, he really is staff. And I do think this is somewhat awkward. He's a very strong, tough guy. But he's been asked some very awkward questions, not very legitimate questions. I just think Senator Devlin and Mr. Peter Buckley and those types should be here answering these questions. Not that you can't handle it. So you just tell Richard I'm looking for him. Whoever, you know, I'm sure he's in the building. I saw him just recently.
I will do that, Senator Courtney.
And Ms. Rucker, we really appreciate your input, too.
We do.
We're trying to figure out, you know, we at the policy side are always at loggerheads, you know, with the Joint Ways and Means. And unfortunately, our staff and your staff who do a great job are sometimes, you know, at the same thing. So we appreciate hearing directly from you, you know, to understand it. And, you know, we're just trying to struggle and figure out, you know, what's a mechanism, because we'd like to get rid of some of these centers and get them consolidated down to something that's sustainable. So, and I know that's not your problem. But
Mr. Chair, I understand that, and I know there's been several consistent efforts over the last few years to do that, and I think it's a we've always felt, in the LFO staff have always felt that's a good thing to do, and it should happen.
Right.
So we've tried to help with that process.
I just wanted to know how much is in that account right now, and isn't it emergency management, the ones that would tell us to go do exactly what the good senator to my left here said?
Mr. Chair, Senator Melissa Anderson, I'm not aware of what the balance is, but it is an account within the military department and the Office of Emergency Management within that department. And And as I mentioned to Senator Boquist, LFO staff has consistently supported the concept of consolidating and using this money for consolidation of the PSAPs. So.
Short.
Very short. I apologize for any aggressiveness at being the junior member on this squad right here. They stuck me into the 911 system in 2011. I've become very passionate about it. And I realize the extreme importance of it, and that's why I'm so passionate about this bill.
And I just want to, Mr. Chair, I just to make a statement. The staff doesn't make the decisions.
I know.
Legislators make the decisions and co-chairs. That's all the point I was trying to make. So that's why I would like to see Mr. Devlin. I'm not going to embarrass him, but tell Richard he'll understand I'm looking for him. So.
And from the chair's point of view, I wanted someone with technical expertise, okay? So, anybody else have comments on either of these tools? Thank you, Mr. Rocker. With that, we're going to close the work session that was open for the purpose of public input on 432 and 434 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 92. Counselor, if you would please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 92 requires school districts to collect and submit data about children of military families as specified annually to the Board of Education if there is an emergency.
And colleagues, if you remember, this is was brought to our committee, I think, by Representative Boones there and Mr. Sansusi, who's going to talk to us, who is related with DOD in some fashion, as usual. Ladies first.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and yes, I did bring this during our joint committee session, and so it's been a real lesson for me to see the SB in front of my bills and realize that that's the upper chamber, and I think that's why we're going first. I am merely the Sherpa in this. You'll hear another bill with us too later today, but Mr. Sansusi, who is a retired military, and I'm sure you've seen him many times before, has come down from Washington State where he lives, but he works all over on these bills, and I'm going to let him explain the bill to you and why we're doing this. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Mark Sansusi. I am the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the 6 Northwestern States, retired Air Force guy. I want to thank you first for years of support on all of our stuff that's been happening ongoing since about 2005 or so. This issue is that started in 2011. The U.S. Government Accountability Office reported that there is no data available on these military-connected students that could be used to assess the academic achievement or educational outcomes or determine where funding needs are the greatest. This issue became a key issue for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office 3 years ago when the DOD determined that GAO was right. Although military children experience myriad educational challenges as a result of their parents' transient military service, there was no method of tracking their attendance and academic progress in public schools. Since we began advocating for this, 13 states, including Texas, Florida, North and South Carolina, Alaska, and Montana, are collecting this data with a report-only field. We have a bill in work actively up in Olympia as we speak, too. Apart from these 13 states, only the United States Department of Education Impact Aid Program collects data on the number of military-connected students by school district. This does not include information on specific schools attended or academic performance of military-connected students. An identifier would identify where military-connected students attend school, their academic performance in reading, math, and science, and graduation rates, and how they perform over time. The identifier would not be intended to create an accountable subgroup, which costs lots of money, as I've learned over the last couple of years, but rather establish a report-only data requirement in the same manner as migrant and homeless children and all other categories already in Oregon law. Identifying this information would help military-connected students by facilitating data-driven decision-making to improve distribution of DOD and local resources, interventions and other support for maximum impact to schools and students in need. It also would be building awareness at the school and classroom level of students that might be affected by the deployment or service of a parent or guardian or by frequent moves. For example, collecting information on attendance can assist in ascertaining whether military children are absent more often during the deployment of their military parents. You should also know that in fiscal year 2014, the Department of Defense awarded nearly $47 million in grants to 44 military connected school districts to enhance academic and transition support programs. These grants were for STEM, foreign language learning, and special education programs. There is money in the fiscal year 2015 budget for grants, but the first thing DOD needs to know is how many military-connected kids would benefit. This identifier will help with that. Now, we realize that Oregon does not have a high number of active duty service members and families. Our last Defense Management Data Center report indicates there are less than just about 400 K-12 age group active duty students, but data from the Office of Military Community Outreach in Military OneSource indicates there are 7,097 total children in Oregon ages 5 through 18 when all branches and including Guard and Reserve kids are added.
School Board Association.
Guard and Reserve kids are also being counted in this measure. Certainly you are well aware that reservists and Guard members are deployed regularly too, with the inherent stress of children and this identity help them too. Finally, nationally, student identifier issue is broadly supported and endorsed by numerous school and military-connected associations to include the Military Child Education Coalition, known as MSEC, American Association of School Administrators, National Association of State Boards of Education, National Military Family Association, Military Officers Association of America, Blue Star Families, the National Guard Association of the United States, the Association of the United States Army, and America's Promise. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for committee for listening to me talk about this, and I stand for any questions. Thank you.
Just one. So we should do this. Oregon should do this because then it would open up the possibility to have grants, federal grants, to help us? Is that?
I would not sit here and try and tie one to the other, okay. but knowing how many kids are in school districts and if a school district communicates with the Department of Defense Education Activity with a proposal for a grant for a STEM or foreign language, then they could be in contention for that. And the first thing that DOD would like to know is how many military kids or Guard kids would be there to benefit from that.
Thank you.
I'll have questions later. Thank you, Lori Saperstein and Commissioner McKeel. Do you have a whole panel with you, Commissioner? We're trying to be efficient, so bring everybody at the same time. Two ladies at the same time. And we'll let the commissioner go first.
Since we have two ladies. And she's my commissioner,
by
the
way. Oh, is
she?
Okay.
Yes,
I am. Does that mean I can go last?
Yo. Did you hear that? Did you want me to go last? You said you want me to go last.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. I'm Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner, and the chair of the Association of Oregon County's Veterans Steering Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and express my strong support for Senate Bill 92. A key role of counties around the state is helping veterans access benefits that they have earned through their service. You heard me testify before about the tremendous impact of county veteran service officers, and I will continue to champion the work that our CVSOs do. Family services are another key area that we need to direct attention and resources to. When a soldier deploys, the family deploys. Furthermore, the struggles with reintegration are not limited to the service member who is returning from combat. I believe it is critical that we develop the partnerships necessary to support military-connected children. One of the first steps in doing so is collecting data so we can strategically build and strengthen these collaborations. The Association of Oregon Counties has voted to support this legislation, and I see a real opportunity to use our relationships with counties, ODVA, and the Oregon National Guard to provide training curriculum or any other resources that may be helpful for schools as we work together to support children with a parent in the military. Thank you.
Thank you. Lori, why don't you go first, then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. Sadly, here with a few concerns about Senate Bill 92, none of which is we want to support all students. And I think this bill is well-intentioned. I think we just passed a bill in February of 14, House or Senate Bill 1506, which is the Military Compact Bill. And there is a provision in that bill already that is we can do data collection through that. I put out some feelers to school districts about the data collection, some tweaks in it that has to go on. What I would like to see is the Military Compact just took effect. It hasn't had a chance to meet. I would rather have a more holistic approach to what kind of data do we need and why. I don't want to have to come back here every session with a different need that we need to go have data collection. I'd rather take a pause, we've got a superintendent on the Military Compact to meet. What is it, what do we need? I know superintendents are already very aware of students that come in, provided they check the box and they know they're military students, especially if it's a larger district, to help the student get integrated and get what they need, whether that's a phone call to where they came from to figure out what's going on, get the records faster. So I just offer that up as a suggestion to try to get that different approach, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The Military Compact, you say that this bill could be met by doing that. I mean, can we send a message to that compact that this is what we would really like? We really need to know the where our military children are, or how many we have, or.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, Mark had already provided me with the amount of students in different counties, and based on their National Guard or what branch of military. In the bill 1506, under Article 9, it says collect standardized data concerning the educational transition of the military families under the compact as directed through rules which specify the data to be collected, the means of collection, the data exchange, and reporting requirements. So I think that it's already there, and I'd like to see folks in Oregon in concert with others that are already doing this to say what do we need, what kind of data, and why.
Follow-up question?
No, I just certainly don't want duplicative services. Mm-hmm. If we really can accomplish that through the Military Compact that we passed a year ago.
Can you refresh my memory? The Military Compact, above it somewhere is, I see the head turning to the right, is the Department of Education, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, come on up. We work differently in this committee. We just give you invitations. So is there a mechanism? What type of data, Commissioner, do you think we're trying to collect? And then the question for if you can give an idea of the types of data we think we need to have. And my question to the esteemed department to your left is there a way to work into this sort of data collection through the compact? Commissioner, what are we looking for?
And I don't know that I have the answer to that, because in my discussions with our school districts, particularly in East County, they don't have the information, and they don't have the mechanism. It's not done school to school out there. And so they all think it's important to have this information and that they know when there are military children in their school. So we are actually, our next meeting at the county is we're having a superintendent come, and we're talking with the National Guard, and we're very connected with them through their children's network as well. So I don't know the exact answers that the schools need, but I do know that, you know, and I'm not sure where the disconnect is, but I don't think that all of the information is getting down to that grassroots level yet. And we're happy to work with anybody that's willing to facilitate that, as are our superintendents. They think this is a very important piece to know. And so I don't know exactly what it is they need, but we will be discussing that.
Well, the dark department can jump in now.
Yeah, there you go.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb with the Oregon Department of Education. So last spring, in 2014, Senate Bill 1509 passed, and I don't know if you recall, we had a little bit of concerns because, well, the original bill had to be rewritten because it was model legislation for this country. And Oregon had a whole different situation, so we had to kind of rewrite the bill. We left in the part about the data collection, mainly because we were told it wasn't going to move forward and there would never be a data collection. And our concern was only if it was going to be a new data collection. Under 92, Senate Bill 92, this just requires us to flag students. And so if it's just to flag students and to collect and to organize data we already collect, there's no fiscal impact. And that's how we are reading the bill in terms of collecting data on academic progress and proficiency. Mm-hmm. We are assuming that that's information we already collect, and so our fiscal is minimal.
So, but is it something we can do without a bill, and we can turn around and say, you know, this is something that we should have been integrated into the other side, and you guys just need to go forth and slay dragons? Or is this a session where we need to have explicit authority? Or do we know?
I think we need explicit authority.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I guess it would depend on what the Interstate Compact decided. If they decided that they were just going to pinpoint information we already collected, then we would work with them and do that without the need for Senate Bill 92. If they were to ask for information that we don't collect and that would cause us to have a fiscal, then we would probably be reluctant to do that and want to come back and maybe to the e-board to get some money to do that.
Commissioner, do you want to relinquish your chair so the Department of Defense can take over your position?
Certainly, I would be happy to do that.
We'll get you out of the gunfire range. Okay?
Was this yours?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Nice to meet you, Jane.
Nice to meet you.
So, Mr. Sansusi, then, I guess the question is that Oregon always forges things differently than everybody else. I mean, everybody's sort of in agreement we need the data. We're just not sure what the data is. And is there data in 92 that we can't do under a compact, or what is your, besides what the boilerplate of the DOD position
is? Mr. Chair, the intent is not to collect anything that you don't already collect in Oregon. I will say that of the 50 states that have now passed the Interstate Compact, the only state that used the Interstate Compact to do the military student identifier piece that we're talking about today is Montana. Montana passed this in 2013, and I don't know exactly why I didn't have Montana then, but they administratively wrote rules that they put out that I've given Laurie a copy starting this fall to ask the question about active duty and Guard Reserve and connection. But of all 50 states that did the compact, they're the only one who decided to use that as an adjunct to collect this. 13 states have been doing this in legislation, and Montana is the only one who's doing it not by legislation.
Well, we could be the next one in theory, right? The importance here, I think, unless I'm missing something here,
the importance here is we have the data available, and we just need to be able to hit the computer to do the right sort so that that is available for a variety of purposes.
And, Mr. Chair, as with all of our issues, if a state is going to do it, whether they do it administratively, rulemaking, or through legislation, as long as they're doing it, we're happy with that.
But how? I would think that, like, well, the commissioner was saying that our East County schools, in my district, don't collect they don't have a way to necessarily collect that data right now. Is there a form when a student comes in, and does it always ask on that form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss-Anderson, I did ask a couple of districts about what this would take for them,
yeah.
And it is revising all of their forms. And some of them will have to do some computer work with some of their enrollment, attendance, all those kinds of things to flag. Some of it's more problematic for maybe a smaller district, but it can be done. It's going to cost, but it can be done.
Anybody else in the panel have anything? All Greek to us.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss-Anderson, in Washington State, with thousands and thousands of military-connected kids, the fiscal note on the ongoing bill we're working now that's passed the Senate and is in the House and vice versa, they have companions up there. The fiscal note is like $10,000 to add the data field into the thing, and whereas an accountable subgroup becomes 200,000 because that's a whole other thing. So a report only is putting the code in, from what I've been told up there.
Well, Madam Vice Chair, I guess they can continue to have the conversation for a while.
Okay.
Since the three of you are there, I would ask the three of you to re-exchange business cards and figure out what is this, you know, what data do we need, and what is the simplest, least expensive way to get it, and what's the benefit for getting the data. I mean, the things that strike out in the back of my mind are districts, as we've all talked about last time, like down in Astoria, Warrington area, where you have a huge Coast Guard base, and then the next one's kind of like down to Kay Falls, where you have a large active duty umbrella and something like that. And I do kind of grasp the idea of, and I understand what they're saying in Multnomah County, and there you're looking more at you know, National Guard and the Portland International Guard base. I mean, I'm not sure the technology you're going to want to have in Burns when there isn't anybody, except maybe one or two kids with the AGRs and the National Guard armory. But a simple way to achieve the best result. So if the three of you would compare notes at some point and get back with us. And I'm sure the commissioner will be happy to referee. So thank you very much.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 92, open a public hearing on SB 97. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 97 requires the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority reinstate home and community-based services for eligible children temporarily removed from the state due to a parent's military service as specified.
Rep Boone.
And I'm back.
This is another one of them, right?
Yes. Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Moss-Anderson, and committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and this is for Senate Bill 97, same thing. I am doing the heavy lifting here, but my compadre, the retired colonel, Sanssouci.
Mr. Chair and committee, for the record, my name is Mark Sanssouci. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwestern States. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 97. This is a new issue for us since last year, and it would allow service members to retain earned priority for receiving Medicaid, home, and community-based services waivers. We think this will greatly help military families with special needs dependents, EFMP program you've heard of, the Exceptional Family Member Program, those people who are Oregonians, so when they return from military service back to their home state, they would stay on the list to qualify for benefits. The problem initially is that independent state Medicaid eligibility requirements and lengthy waiting lists hinder military families from obtaining supplemental financial support for their children with special needs, especially when transitioning out of the military with potentially uncertain medical coverage. SB 97 helps those families by enabling them to earn the same priorities as afforded every state resident. resident. SB 97 seeks to allow active duty service members to use their state of legal residence to register their special needs family members for a Medicaid waiver. Enrollment for waivers in their resident state will allow family members to progress along with other state citizens until they become eligible to receive benefits once they move back to Oregon after separating or retiring from military service. The intent is that eligibility status is retained as long as the member maintains the state of his or her legal residency and returns to the state after military separation. The member either received credit for the time on the list or begins receiving benefits when they return home. Because the realities of military mobility from state to state, being enrolled in the state they designate as their legal residence by paying taxes, voting, registering vehicles, driver's license, etc., seems to make sense. One family I know personally described it best up in Washington State. Military family with a Down syndrome child had established eligibility of that child as developmentally disabled and qualified for the waiver. The requirement to take the child, but the requirement would be to take that child back in once again after coming back to prove that that child was had Down syndrome was like picking the scab all over again, according to the mom. This family in Washington State was thrilled just to not have to go through that turmoil again when returning to the state and was most appreciative of just that aspect of this legislation alone. We know that TRICARE does not cover the cost of services for military family members enrolled in the Exceptional Family Member Program with multiple medical conditions where 24-hour care and or long-term custodial care services may be required. Care costs could add up to $400 or more per day in out-of-pocket costs to military members depending on their care needs. We worked with, and I worked up there in Tacoma with a national group named STOMP, Specialized Training for Military Parents, and they conducted a nationwide survey of 254 military families with special needs children from July to October 2013, and they found that 45% applied for Medicaid help for things not covered by TRICARE ECHO, like respite care, incontinence supplies, special infant formulas, personal support, home and vehicle adaptations, rehabilitative services, specialized clothing, among a long list. Of those families in the survey, 64% got benefits, 65% were on a waiting list, and that's also key. The longest wait, 58% had waits of over 4 years as the longest wait times, 17% had waits of 2 to 4 years, and 10% had waits of 1 to 2 years. I have that SOMP survey data available if the committee would like it. Since our introduction advocacy of this issue in the states last year, the states of Washington, Alaska, Illinois, South Carolina, and Florida have begun providing this benefit to our military families. We ask that you do too. In Washington State and Alaska, where I worked this last year successfully, there was no fiscal note to consider. We know that in making policy decisions, that's crucial for you. Numbers are always important, although they cannot predict how many are, in fact, residents of Oregon and will take advantage of this policy help, but we know from Defense Management Data Center data that last year there were 904 active duty sponsors, spouses, and children up to 19 years of age, and 25,000 or more just in reserve as guard in the state of Oregon. So we don't know how many of those are resident Oregonians. We don't know. But we do know is that last year, according to our data, that for all the service components, 1,443 active duty service members separated or retired from the military and returned home to Oregon. So how many of those that are doing this annually have special needs family members? We also don't have the data, but you can figure 10 to 20% of any of those families have developmentally disabled children as a rule of thumb. So the bottom line here is we're not asking to create a special group of people in this effort. We're asking the state to maintain the benefits extended to all qualified residents, but enable those residents in the military to keep their earned eligibility status in Oregon until they can return home to use it again. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing this. I stand for any questions.
You understand this, Madam Vice
Chair?
Yeah,
just a comment. I mean, we did the very same thing for inmates in corrections. We have sent them into corrections. They lose their Medicaid, and then they get out out of jail and they have to go through the whole process of reapplying. So we did pass legislation that will allow them to be able to keep their benefits until they get out. So, you know, we don't. Do we have the Oregon Health Authority here?
Absent without leave, both of them.
Yeah, but this is extremely important issue because parents with those children that are disabled have a tough enough time as it is. And just by just suspending and keeping them so they don't have to reapply, it's just a godsend. So I think it's a good bill.
Is this doable? I mean, I'm coming over my
yes,
head
and that's
one.
Why the Oregon Health Authority should be here, but because it's doable for our inmates, so I assume it would be doable here.
Should we issue them an invitation for next week? Because, I mean, I'm in over my head on this one. I'm relying on your expertise.
It would be Medicaid, whoever is in charge of the Medicaid.
It's the MAP, or the assistance program, right? Yeah.
OHA.
OHA.
Yeah, OHA.
Questions, Mr. President?
Senator Olson, question?
I think I grasp it. And what we'll do is we'll ask them to come in next week.
It could be DHS, too, though. I'm not sure.
We'll ask both. The bill actually means DHS, the Oregon Health Authority, or an entity with contracts with the department, or the authority to determine eligibility of home and community-based services.
Yeah. So
thank God it's not covered. Mm-hmm. So,
DHS and OHA, because one would be the health plan, and then the other would be...
Yeah. Right. So we can roll. We'll roll 97 forward to next week and ask them to come up, explain how it could be done. Other questions? With that, greatly appreciate. There's no one else signed up. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 97 and open a public hearing on SB 638. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 638 permits each county to appoint volunteer veterans ombudsmen with specified qualifications to complement county veterans service officers.
Commissioner, you're up again. Director Smith, Mary Jagger. You can lead off, Commissioner.
Okay, thank you. For the record, I'm Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner and Chair of the AOC Veterans Committee. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 638. This is a bill that the Association of Oregon Counties has voted to support as recommended by our Veterans Steering Committee. Oregon has a diverse population of veterans who come to the county and other partners around the state with a wide range of needs. Our county veteran service officers do excellent work and they fill a vital role, but some issues fall outside the scope of their claims and advocacy role. The ombudsman position would be an important resource that would support veterans and fill any gaps between different services at the county level. Whether it's finding out about benefits, seeking housing, or some other assistance, each system can be cumbersome to navigate and confusing for the individual. The ombudsman, even in a volunteer capacity, as described in this bill, would be a valuable resource for our veterans, and I believe would help improve the effectiveness of other programs at the local and state level on behalf of our veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, before we go on, just to make sure I understand, it's the position of the counties you believe you need the permissive language, right? That's what
yes.
I'm guessing.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Director, I'm going to let you jump in first before Ms. Jagger gets.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to thank Commissioner McKeel coming down from Multnomah County. We've had a strong partnership on that AOC Veterans Task Force over the last year and a half under her tenure and also her advocacy on the Veterans Committee at the national level for NACO, the National Association of Counties. We had just met yesterday with the counties discussing this and a lot of support on this concept in terms of tapping into that sea of goodwill that we know exists for our veterans and military families. And then even today at our staff meeting at OVA, somewhat shifting even off of what we discussed yesterday. There is broad support for it, but I think we want this, the opportunity is so vast and such a good one that we want to make sure that we do it right in terms of tapping into volunteers. there is huge leverage that we've seen in models in terms of costs of the court-appointed special advocates helping navigate foster kids through the court system, where the court staff doesn't have the time to go check in with the neighbors, the schools, the relatives. Being able to help walk that family and that child through the system, what Mary Yeager will speak to in terms of the long-term care ombudsman program, much the same. The shell staff that they have had, you know, 10 to 12 staff, but then leveraging 200 some volunteers to go around to skilled nursing facilities where paid staff at the state and county level can't always be there. The model is pure. I question a little bit the ombudsman. To me, that has a little bit of a kind of regulatory or, you know, an oversight function on the county VSOs that I don't think is intended. But huge opportunity to tap into the sea of goodwill on volunteers. But I think some put together a lot of thought, I think, in terms of what does the training component look like for these volunteers? What does the supervision look like? Is there fingerprinting and background checks? The mileage reimbursement, often in the rural areas for the volunteer corps, we see mileage as sometimes a reimbursable expense that we would want to add in. What is the scope of work? What are the privacy concerns? How do we build guidelines that they are able, as volunteers, to see sometimes very protected and personal information? But that it is structured. And this is something that we are passionate about, have not necessarily had the expertise to tap into it, I think, from the our Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but have now stolen Mary Yeager away from the long-term care ombudsman to come lead our aging veteran services. And I think some great statutes to model, both out of that CASA model and the long-term care ombudsman, but it would be a little more robust than just this bill. And something that we would not often volunteer for work groups and task forces, but I think this is an opportunity that is so good that we would want to put additional work with our county partners and with some other experts in volunteer areas to really tee this up for what would be a more robust bill and potentially with a slice of funding to make sure that we acknowledge that veterans or volunteers, while highly leveraged, using volunteers is not a free system, and you got to do it right. And I'll turn over to my colleague, Mary Yeager.
Please.
So for the record, I'm Mary Yeager. I am now the Aging Services Director for the Department of Veteran Affairs, but come to this work with 5.5 years as Oregon's Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and then 10 years running the CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocate Program, in Multnomah and Washington County. You will not find a bigger fan of volunteers than I. I firmly believe that Oregonians have just got that volunteerism in their blood, and combined with both what the commissioner and the director have said, to tap into this amazing goodwill that is out there for veterans is a perfect opportunity. Director Smith already outlined some of our brainstorming concerns, but I just want you to know that we are more than willing to do everything possible to make this model work. Oregon's a perfect place to try it. There's a lot of great brainstorming that can go on east-west, urban-rural. And again, as the director said, there are several models in Oregon already that capitalize on the goodwill of volunteers with some structure behind it. So thank you for letting me comment.
Okay, Director Smith. You've been in politics too long. Are you saying you want to amend the bill? You want to do something different with the bill? Put your Marine Corps back hat on and get down to, like, paragraph three here, okay?
So, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I always get nervous. I think it's a deeper level of engagement than just in this session. I could be wrong on that front, but I think it would be a work group that we would present back by September to be able to tee up a larger piece for the February session.
Okay. You still tap dancing. Are you in favor or are you opposed to 638?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I think I would not move forward at this time on the bill, and I think putting more thought into it, whether through the amendments and or through a larger work group process, would behoove us.
And Commissioner, your thoughts?
Thank you. Well, we voted to support the bill in our committee, so we stand with that support. But I do think, and we discussed this a bit yesterday at our committee, too, and I do think there's merit in what the director is saying. At looking at the how we do structure and how we do train the volunteers. Some of the counties around the state have a wonderful volunteer corps with their veteran service offices. Wasco County is almost all volunteers, and they do an amazing job. But they do have a very good coordinator and a very good training piece. So I think all of those details are important to certainly address at some point.
Vice Chair, questions?
Well, no. I mean, the bill could pass with maybe a slight change in implementation date. I mean, that's always a possibility, too, making it, you know, that we want this to go, but there needs to be planning time. I don't, you know.
Sir,
I like to push the envelope just because.
I'm about ready to do that.
Okay.
Recording, comments? Sir Olson? We're going to schedule for a work session in 2 weeks. We either have an amendment or don't. So, and I guess since you're part of it, you're going to get asked about the fiscal anyway. So, and if you'd reach out, I believe this actually came from Senator Canova originally,
Yes.
even though my name is on there. So if you reach out to Senator...
You're a chief also.
Yeah, I know, but I only signed on to his bill, I think. Right? So it's his bill. So you reach out to him. So if we need to add, you know, a bumper board that says, you know, this is step one, or we want to do something, or we need to come back, you know, throw it in there, come back with a way to, you know, whatever we need to do. So you have 2 weeks, and then we're going to do something. Anything else, Madam Vice Chair?
No, but I think that, you know, implementation and setting up rules, I mean, it's going to take some time because, yeah.
Okay. So we're splitting it. So the counties get their way, and the director gets his way. He only gets 2 weeks instead of you asked for 6 months, wasn't it? No, you asked for 9 months, right?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, we'll get it done.
Right. See, it's a Marine Corps thing. You asked for 9 months, you got 2 weeks. Okay, I think it's perfectly fair. With that, we'll close the public hearing on SB 638. Colleagues, that clears the calendar off. I will note that 97 and 638. They're going to prepare the documents for 92. There's some discussion that needs to be done on that one, and I will circle back around on 432 and 434 with members. And I don't need to do this. Okay. And with that, unless there's anything else, we're done for the day. Thank you, colleagues.